People write to me every day to tell me they fear the future. People from all over the world, all ages, all walks of life. I say this, we should not be afraid. If anyone should be afraid, it's our government, the whole of Parliament, the state, and the establishment. They should be afraid because they are in the wrong, doing wrong things and behaving unforgivably. You can tell they are afraid by the way they keep doing more and more, faster and faster, to make the people poor, cold and hungry. Also demoralised, anxious and fearful about the present, never mind the future. The fear felt by people around the world is the deliberate consequence of the actions of so-called leaders all across the West and beyond. I say again, we should not be afraid. Those plotting and working against us, against our interests, both as individuals and as sovereign states, have no power and no money other than that which we, the people, grant them. They're supposed to use that power and money to protect us, to keep us free, and to provide opportunities for those hard-working, free people to make happy and successful lives for themselves. Instead, they're working night and day to have us welcome a state of being that is nothing less than digital enslavement. Many of the people who contact me ask, what should we do? How can we fight back? I think about the answers to those questions all the time. Right now, I wonder what would happen if those who are cold in their homes, millions of people, just turned on their heating and turned off their direct debits and standing orders. What would happen if, when the bills came, we all just agreed to toss them on the fire, all of us together? What would happen if millions of us, peacefully acting as one, just stood together in quiet defiance? I could be wrong, but I don't think there's enough cells in the prisons, enough judges to hear the cases. If the system wasn't already broken by them, such actions would break it. What would happen if we all withdrew our money from the banks on the same day? What would happen if we all asked, as we are entitled to, for the cash? The banks don't have the money to meet all those demands, and so presumably they would close their doors. Then what? Would their inability to pay out all that cash be evidence of the fraud that is fiat money? I wonder. More and more strikes are happening. Rail workers, teachers and university lecturers. Nurses next. What about the self-employed who are abandoned for the last 2 years? They can't strike. What would happen if they withheld their taxes all at the same time? I wonder. I don't have the answers to all of the questions, but I know this much. Even just asking them, airing the thoughts, should make the government, the state, the establishment sit up and pay attention. I've said it before and I'll say it again. The social contract, that notion by which we surrender power to the state in return for services and safety, is beyond broken. They broke it, not us. Successive governments, not just the present bunch of cardboard cutouts, have, over decades, knowingly and deliberately betrayed every aspect of that contract. It is null and void, and we, the blameless party, are no longer bound by its conditions. We, the people, the sovereign people of this country, don't just hold the power. We are the power. We loan some of it, a short-term loan, to governments. And those governments are supposed to serve us, do our bidding. Never the other way round. We tell them what to do. Hundreds of years' worth of governments have quietly and secretively presided over a financial system that is no more than state-sanctioned fraud. Power to create money out of thin air was put in the hands of an entirely private, unelected, unaccountable business, and this power has been abused to make a tiny group unimaginably rich by enslaving all of us with debt. That system is now on the point of collapse. The West is bankrupt, and governments and bankers are scrabbling to solve a problem. How to subtract every last shekel from the people while still having a handful of wealthy bankers and their enablers left over. Britain has no functioning border against the rest of the world. Hundreds are arriving in this country every day and night, many ferried across the Channel by agencies paid for by British taxpayers. British people have to wait longer for health and social care and accommodation to make way for economic migrants with their eyes on a soft touch, who have paid illegal gangs thousands of pounds a head to get here. They send their luggage on ahead and collect it at their hotels. We are at the back of the queue while anyone else from anywhere else is looked after hand and foot. And always the loudest calls are not for stopping it, but for more money and faster processing. I wonder if the illegal immigration isn't just convenient for the state, softening up the citizens for a supposed solution like digital ID, perhaps, and then borders open once and for all? I wonder. The British people are no longer kept safe by the police force they pay for. Burglaries of properties and assaults on the person are barely investigated, while officers prioritise thought crimes on social media. Uncounted thousands of little girls are abandoned to organised gangs of rapists up and down the country because the state turned a blind eye to the relentless raping of children rather than ruffle community feathers. A tenth of the population is on the waiting list for treatment by the NHS. The National Health Service is not keeping the nation healthy. All this about free at the point of the delivery is about as much use as a magic spell. You can call a lunch a free lunch, but you'll still be left hungry if you can't get into the restaurant. So-called free steaks won't fill you up if you have to wait so long in the queue you starve to death in the meantime. Free becomes another word for something you've heard about but can't have. I say again, though, we have nothing to fear, not if we decide to be unafraid. In many ways, the worst has already happened. We've been shown where we stand in the eyes of the state, which is beneath their contempt. But history tells us we should never underestimate the power of the many. Just over 100 years ago, during World War I, thousands of workers were pulled into the city of Glasgow to work in the munitions factories. At that time, there wasn't a single council house or flat in the whole of Britain. Private landlords owned 100% of homes for rent. They could and did raise rents as often as they wanted. Tenants either paid up or were evicted. In February 1915, landlords across the city told tenants their rents were going up by as much as 25%. This was against a backdrop of the steeply rising cost of living generally, food scarcity and the rest. There was a war to win, remember, and sacrifices were expected from the people if the enemy was to be defeated. In the case of many homes, the man of the house was away fighting in the war, leaving just women and children. Into this crisis for poor people stepped Mary Barber, an ordinary Glasgow woman with two children. She and others realised their only hope lay in sticking together. A mass non-payment campaign got underway. Arrears built up and soon sheriff's officers were turning up to demand back rent or to evict non-payers. But whenever anyone got wind of an eviction, hundreds of women would descend on the address and block the entrance to the home. A Glasgow MP, Willie Reid, described a typical incident. Quote, a soldier's wife in Parkhead had an eviction notice served on her with a warning that if she failed to vacate her house by 12 noon, the sheriff's officer would call to enforce it. The strike committee got busy. They instructed every mother in the district with a young child to be there for 11 a.m. on D-Day, complete with prams. Long before noon, the close and street were packed with prams and every pram had at least one youngster in it. No raiding party could have got near the house. Moreover, the men of Parkhead Forge and other works in the district decided to down tools at 11:30 a.m. and lend a hand if necessary. People began to talk about Mary Barber's army. On the 17th of November, 18 tenants appeared in court for eviction. Tens of thousands of Glasgow people lined the streets outside. In the end, on the 25th of November 1915, rents were frozen at pre-war levels. The Increase of Rent and Mortgage Interest Act 1915 was passed, and some elements of it remained in force as late as 1989. I wonder what would happen if all of us opposed to what is going on now came together like those Glasgow women of 1915 and just said no. I wonder. When thinking about that time, I'm reminded of real leaders. I've been talking again this week about Ernest Shackleton, who, when all seemed lost, his ship sunk beneath the Antarctic ice and with nothing but flimsy tents, three little boats and 28 men trapped on the pack ice and depending on him for life itself, he said, well, now we'll go home. Our so-called leaders tell us our lives must be filled with hardship while they warm themselves in centrally heated homes paid for with our taxes, and look forward to Christmas parties and food and drink and decorations paid for by all of us. That's not leadership. That's an abusive relationship. Shackleton put himself through every hardship he expected his men to endure. He did it first and for longest. What he asked of them, he did too. He said they should leave behind on the ice anything that would not help keep them alive. So saying, he walked to a hole in that ice and dropped in his gold watch and cigarette case to the bottom of the ocean. He led from the front every step of the way and over nearly 1,000 miles of the cruelest sea on earth. And in the end, he got every man home. They called him the boss. He cared not a jot for the comforts of home. Back home once more, he wrote, "We had pierced the veneer of outside things. We had suffered, starved and triumphed, grovelled down and grasped at glory, grown bigger in the bigness of the whole." He was a leader who saw that it was shared endeavour and shared striving that made all else possible. Our leaders would pick our pockets for any gold watches and valuables before climbing aboard their private jets and flying home, leaving us behind on the melting ice. I say we owe them nothing, not our loyalty and not our obedience. If we continue to comply, we build our own prison around ourselves for their benefit. They've promised us the earth while stealing it from us, raping and pillaging its resources only for their own enrichment. I say again, there's nothing to fear if we have each other. Here's the thing. If we set a course for ourselves and back each other every step of the way, we will cross this ocean of darkness together.